This is the Amp Hour Podcast. Released November 20th, 2023. Episode 651. Learning Computing with Jeff Geerling. Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Chris Gamble of Contextual Electronics.
And I'm Jeff Geerling from Jeff Geerling YouTube and all over the place. Also Geerling Guy. Some people know me as Geerling Guy Geerling from way guy. Back yeah. in the day.
Yeah. I was reading a Hacker News thread that said like, oh, I know Jeff from like Ansible and things like that. I didn't quite know what Ansible was, but I had seen you'd written a book about it and stuff like that. So I think most people will know your YouTube videos and your... Yeah. If they don't know your YouTube videos, then we're going to send them there. That's for sure, right?
Definitely.
I think you might be one of the most calming voices in the technology industry. I just like watch your videos. I'm like, yeah, Jeff's got it. He's in hand, you know, like, oh, Raspberry Pi 5. I'm not stressed. You know.
Part of that is the fact that I record at night after my kids are in bed. It's like, my own. I got to get into a Zen state because the day was just crazy. That's how every day is, you know?
Yeah. That's a good idea. That's a good idea. And, you know, I think it lands. So like, you know, you do all kinds of mini computers and you're kind of crossing the chasm between like small custom electronics all the way up to like server side stuff. I mean, how did that happen?
So it's funny. My dad is a radio engineer and he actually had me start coming and helping him with things at the station. My brother and I both did this for years. We would come and, you know, have father son days at the station or whatever. I think it was more because like my mom needed somebody to watch him and he knew that we were well behaved enough that we wouldn't break anything. But what I got to do was see the transition in radio from everything analog to everything digital. And in the midst of that, it was like anything from cleaning a cart machine to going up on the roof and cleaning something to building an antenna to replacing parts in something like a cassette deck. And then starting to get into like working on AS400 file server, setting up Windows NT, fixing printers and things. So I got the whole gamut from software to hardware. The thing that I loved the most at the station was my dad had me documenting things. So eventually I actually got hired on at the station as an assistant engineer. And my first project was building an IT operations manual. So basically everything from like monthly maintenance tasks to, you know, everything goes off the air. What's the process for that? What things to check first in the studio? So I got to see the whole gamut and I really loved the software side the most that because it was, you know, when I was growing up, that was software was just eating the world, as it were. And so I got into web development. I got into programming for the web servers and things. And then it was really only in the past 5 or 10 years that I got back into the electronic side and the hardware side so much because I realized that all these things, so many things were kind of going out of the grasp of the common person to be able to do microelectronics and microcontrollers. And with the ESP devices and with the Raspberry Pi Pico, normal programmers who might have never touched hardware like me for many years could get back into it without having to learn all the deep down guts of how to program a microcontroller and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I was thinking about like kind of the top, like I kind of think of like what you're describing here is like kind of top down software coming back down into the hardware. And my experience was hardware going up into the software layer. And there's this different set of challenges, right? I mean, like for me, it's like as I'm like learning Zephyr and like device tree and just like Linuxy type thing, you know, like the struggles there are slightly different than, you know, a lot of the software people that I've taught in the past are like, well, you know, what's this triangle with a line? I'm like, that's a diode, you know? And they're like, yeah, but like, why does it do what it's doing? You know, like, and it's just like a different, I don't know. It's a different set of challenges, I feel like.
Yeah. And I think that one of the hard things is a lot of people in our generation haven't had the experience of going from the circuit to the code.
Yes.
They just code things and you throw it up in the cloud and you might never understand that there's transistors somewhere that's running this stuff and they heat up and they there are problems and there's cosmic rays, like all these things that you don't think about that if you want to be the best, you have to understand a lot of these things. And I would not qualify as even close to the best, I would say, in either software or hardware. I'm just good at putting a nice coat on the, you know, painting it over and showing people how to do something. But
well, there's best around explaining things though and like making it accessible. That's its own.
Yeah,
it's a different skill set, right?
The sad thing is that most of the people that are unbelievable at this stuff are just so bad at communicating it.
You know? Yeah, right.
You need both.
Right.
And you know, some companies are better at that. Some individuals are better at that. So I try to put a spotlight on some things that I see that are really cool in the world. And I see a lot around Raspberry Pis and single board computers, a lot around Linux and open source. So that's what I shine my spotlight on.
Yeah. And I feel like there's a lot of pigeonholing as well, right? So I think about the people that are the best at like PLL design on, you know, high-end processors and things like that. Like that person's been sitting in a cube in Intel for 30 years. And like, even if you wanted to get to them, that they're going to tell you things that are like so niche and like awesome, of course, right? But they're not going to be contextualized for kind of the broader audience or honestly very applicable to what is happening. So I feel like kind of that zoomed out view as well, being like, why does this matter for software and hardware and everything else? That is also really important.
Yeah. And I have another YouTube channel that I run with my dad called Gearling Engineering. My goal is for us to get more into RF and electronics. Right now we talk about a little bit of RF with tower site tours and things like that. But I think that like his generation, a lot of them are retiring. Some of them are even dying off. And that's a whole set of knowledge that our generation has not gotten a lot of times, because a lot of these companies don't have the sense of apprenticeship that we used to have, where, you know, you'd work under somebody for a long time. And I got that from my dad because he let me work with him on big projects. Yeah. I went with him to tower sites when they were rebuilding towers, and he learned some of the electronics and the basic principles of things. And for me, I always thought, man, that looks so cool. I want to be able to do this stuff. And then I got into software. So I'm getting a little bit back into his stuff, but now I'm, you know, it's for YouTube and things like that. So I'm not really in the weeds building production hardware. Right. So it's a lot different, but I do want to bring that to other people and get people interested in this because, you know, like for instance, AM radio, it's kind of dying off in the US and, you know, there's different opinions on whether it's even going to exist in 10 or 20 years as a commercial venture, but I'm trying to help my dad and, you know, extract that information from him in a way that's interesting to people so we can see, you know, here's how that worked and you can really draw a connection from the circuit to what's happening in the magic of RF with AM. It's harder to do that with FM because conceptually it's harder to explain FM to somebody that doesn't already know something about radio. AM, it's like more power, more signal, speaker goes vibrate, you know, it's you can draw that line between those things. So
wiggle here, wiggle there.
And I think the same thing with computing, and that's why I like the Raspberry Pi Pico and the ESP32 and things like that, because they are closer to that where you can understand my code and, you know, wires that go into this board, bringing different signals across. And then my software can see that too and interact with it. Even if you don't understand the assembly, or a lot of people, they might never even program in C. It might all be Python, MicroPython.
Yeah, MicroPython, CircuitPython has been just like opening up a lot of embedded. I feel like it's very, very accessible. It's awesome. I mean, the cycle time to go and like revise something is unbelievable as well.
Yes.
On the RF side of things. So what level are you kind of investigating stuff at? You said, you know, you're looking at AM radio and things like that. Are you also doing are you a ham as well? Are you getting into that world, building stuff?
I just got my license a few months ago. So, you know, for years and years, I've thought, oh, that'd be cool to do, but I never was like, and I'm going to do it this year. I was like, my dad is not retired, but he's, you know, at some point he's going to be retired and he has all this wealth of knowledge. And in my mind, I'm like, he could probably pass the extra exam without even thinking about it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
With him, it's funny though. Like he's been in broadcast engineering and he's had his broadcast FCC license and all that for years and years. He's dealt with 50,000 watt AMs and 30 kilowatt FMs. And he was part of the team that built what's called the Super Tower. We call it that in St. Louis. It has 8 FM stations combining to 300 kilowatts with a megawatt of ERP broadcast out. So it covers all the St. Louis area. It was, I mean, looking at, I
you have a video about that, I think, right? You
I do,
video,
yeah.
I think, on the, I remember the, seeing a video about
yeah, exploring
that,
yeah. the million watt. Yeah. And then I was also like, is it really a million watts? Because everybody's like, it's not really a million watts. It's like, well, let me explain.
Yeah, don't listen to people on the internet. Come on, man.
So, I mean, technically it's 300,000 watts, but, you know, splitting hairs here because it's, you know, we don't want to broadcast all the FM up into the atmosphere. That's not very useful unless you're in an airplane, I guess. Yeah, but it's, he has all that knowledge, and I wanted to see, like, he's the kind of guy who will keep a sharp mind, and he's a great grandpa. He loves playing with the kids and everything too. And the kids always see his desire to learn, but I also wanted him to get into a hobby that can take that knowledge that he's gained from radio continue it on. So I'm trying to get him into software. He's still a hardware guy.
Yeah.
And he does some IT stuff. I mean, everybody in radio does IT now because it's all IP. But he still has all that knowledge from, transmitter setup and studio builds and all that, that I want to get him into. Maybe he could make a really cool rig. And he actually carries around his radio on his hip all the time.
Nice.
He has his little handheld, so.
I don't know. I mean, I guess probably he's too deep in the world of like having a license and understanding that stuff. And maybe like he just starts a pirate station once he retires. He's just like, you know what? I'm going off the script.
So he's the kind of engineer that would work with other engineers to like fox hunt somebody that was doing something illegal.
Yeah, right.
Because he's like, it's clipping into our signal in this little region. Like he's one of the few engineers that still cares so much. It seems like corporate in radio broadcast in the U.S., has been falling out. They're more into streaming and internet now.
Yeah.
And I get it. The revenues, the growth opportunities are definitely not there with broadcast radio these days, but it's still a huge thing. So, you know, he would have stuff in his car and he'd be monitoring signals and stuff. He'd call the FCC and talk to them. And so, he's not like an enforcer.
Calling the FCC on purpose instead of like, I messed up. That's usually I'm calling him like, oh, I'm sorry.
but he's worked with so many different hams before. Like some of the antenna work that he's done, he said like the hams are the guys who I talk to about this stuff because they know it better than he does because they're sitting there experimenting. He's like, I just need to get the antenna up and I need to make sure it's working right. And I have the broadcast equipment. Plus he can get some money and buy a new thing. Whereas a ham might be like, I'm going to get everything I can out of this antenna.
That's cool. No, that's definitely a great hobby. Ham is going through transitions too. We've had people on the show here talking about it, digital modes, things like that. Our friend Jeff Kaiser is a big ham, and it's interesting space. I mean, like it's going through transformations, but it's not quite there yet. I think 10 to 15 years because there's some like old hams as well. I mean,
yeah, it's amazing seeing the differences. Like when I took my test, it was, everybody was 60 plus.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Easily 60
Yeah. The ones
plus.
Like administering it and stuff.
Yeah. And you can tell like, they're like, I got my thing and I talk on the radio and it's my thing, whereas I'm like, I want to connect the Raspberry Pi. I want to do some digital stuff. Right. I want to like emulate some TV transmission. I want to bounce off the moon. I want to, all these fun things, but in ways that are a little different than the old like sitting in your chair and talking like you're on CB radio or something. So I have QSL cards. I've only sent one to my dad because he was my first and only contact so far. I do want to do some of that for the fun of it, see how it is, and also build a little collection of contacts.
I saw it's interesting too, just like the combination with the internet and like all this ham stuff. I saw this site the other day, and of course it was like written in, hand-coded HTML. It was just like hideous. It's great. It felt unique and very, very real, but it was like, you could then tap into SDRs all over the world and like potentially you could transmit from your house and then like listen on the radio, the SDR that's in Russia and be like, did I get there?
And I know sometimes I pop open Kiwi SDR and it's even if you want to listen to like, what is the WWV, listen to the time signal or something, see how certain signals propagate at night.
Yeah.
We're actually going to post a video on Camo X, which is a 50 kilowatt AM here in St. Louis. Okay. We did a tour of their facility and we had like 3 hours of footage and I'm like, we got to make this digestible. So we got it down to 44 minutes with the help of an editor who's really good at just cutting things out. Cause if I did it, I'd be like, oh, but that's so interesting.
And yeah. Right.
Like,
gotta keep that
but
in.
You know, if you want to get more than 10 views on the video, you got to cut some stuff. But, you know, you can pop that open and see where, you know, like in Oklahoma, how strong is the signal in New York. And it's amazing to see that and learn more about the different types of signals too.
So what about that? I mean, you mentioned the getting people to kind of care and listen and stuff like that. I did notice that you have YouTube shorts and you're a very digital native kind of person. You definitely understand the media landscape, that sort of thing. But kind of at a high level, how are you keeping people interested in this stuff? I mean, some of it is maybe natural, but I think some of it is also your style, right? Like some of it's the topic area, but definitely how you do it and present it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two halves to it. One is you have to be interested in it to get other people interested. And I think that's like the number one reason why I don't watch corporate stuff almost ever. Like it's really hard to watch corporate videos on something. But as an example, I have the server, it's called the Mars 400, and it's from a company called Embedded somewhere. I think they're in Taiwan, or maybe, I don't remember. I'm not going to say where exactly I think they are because I don't know. And, you know, maybe it's in a place that's affiliated with somewhere that gets you blacklisted or whatever.
Got it.
But anyway, I have the server and like their videos for it are like I think it's really cool. And I can see that through their video. And you can tell that the engineer thinks it's cool, but they just can't communicate that. So when I take it, I see like inside of it, there's 8 ARM nodes. It's actually 8 servers in one with 8 drive bays and 2 power supplies and 2 switches. So to me, it's like, this is like everything a Raspberry Pi cluster wants to be. It's a commercial product. It's reliable. It has dual redundancy for everything. And if you put 3 in your rack, you can do a full upgrade while you're copying files over to a Ceph cluster running on these things. Like to me, it's like, this is cool. It's fulfillment.
Jeff, you might have to explain some of these terms to me too. Sorry, I'm not.
Well, I mean, the thing is like on my channel, I've done a bunch of Raspberry Pi clusters where you put a bunch of Raspberry Pis together. And everybody always asks like, but what would you do with that? What's so important about building a cluster of Raspberry Pis? Why not just like buy one little PC that's faster than them? And it's like, it's not about the speed. It's about the learning and the opportunity. You put these things together. You have to learn networking. You have to learn how to power them. You have to learn how to manage them. And, you know, not everything in the world can fit on one computer. You can scale up one computer a lot, but you can't scale it infinitely. So there's a point where everybody has to go to multiple computers. And you can learn that on $35 or $60 Raspberry Pis. Or you could learn it on PCs that use a lot more energy and they have fans that are louder and they create more heat and stuff. So I choose to do it on Pis. And when you see these things like this Mars 400 product, it's that, but commercialized. And then you realize, okay, so now all these skills I learned on the Raspberry Pi can actually be useful in the real world for a storage server or for other types of servers that are out there.
Okay. And then you're starting to kind of emulate the kind of the infrastructure of the internet as well. Is that kind of the thinking there? Because you'd have a database somewhere and you'd have store, you know, like long-term storage somewhere else, that sort of idea.
For years and years, I hosted a Drupal website. Drupal's an open source content management system, and it runs a ton of the top like 1,000 websites.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I ran it on a Pi cluster. And not only do you learn how to split up services and manage the cluster, but I also found one bug with the way that Drupal generated aggregated CSS files. So it would like take your CSS and put it all into one file, and then it would save that to the file system to serve up more quickly instead of serving a bunch of CSS files. Mm-hmm. There was a bug in the way that it did that if you were on a cluster and the cluster's disk access was slow, like it would be on a Raspberry Pi. It uncovered that bug more deeply. Like some people were having this on real clusters, but that's because if you run your stuff on Amazon or on Google or whatever, sometimes disks are slow. Most of the time they're not, but sometimes they are. And so it's really hard to debug there. But on the Pi, it exposed that flaw because it's always slow. So it's funny, you know, it's a random thing, but there is value in doing things smaller scale and learning on a test cluster like that. It's not just about getting clicks, you know, it also is interesting. People love seeing like, what can you do with something that's totally underpowered for the purpose?
Yeah.
You know, how far can you take it? It's kind of like if you build a rice rocket, like a car, and you stuff things into it and make it go really fast. That's what I like to do with Raspberry Pis a lot of times.
That's great. No, I think that's strategic slowness, right? That's strategic of it's like basically like stress testing a system, right? It's like stress testing how you might deploy in the real world. And like you said too, I think the the fact that a lot of these cloud services, you can just chuck more money at it most of the time, you know, like, or hand it off to someone else's DevOps ability, you know, like, yeah, that's great until it's not. And
yeah, and the constraint gives me a story automatically, which is a big difference.
Interesting.
So I don't do a video without a story. Even if it's like a simple review type video, I need to have a story for it. Otherwise, it's not like, you know, I subscribe to probably 300 or 400 YouTube channels, and I watch a ton of videos. I watch way too much. I'm sure my wife would say, like, yeah, he watches too much YouTube. But I like to see that, like, there are some creators on YouTube who I see have that same kind of, like, they want to have a story, not a product. And even if you're just a review channel, which I would say I'm not that, I review a lot of things, but it's not reviews most of the time. It's like, here's a challenge and I use this thing to achieve my goal. But having the constraints of a Raspberry Pi or a microcontroller or a budget or something that has the story of, here's my, you know, here's the battle. I'm against the budget, or I'm against the speed of this thing. Yeah. And how am I going to overcome that challenge? And that's more enticing than, this is a really cool thing. It has a processor. It's like, nobody cares about that.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So it's like, what is the challenge? What is the opportunity? And how did you solve it? And, or how did you fail spectacularly every once in a while?
Yeah. So, okay. If I'm taking the perspective of the hardware person coming up the stack, and you're going to take the perspective of the software person coming down the stack, for someone like me, what is the project that you would point people at? So like, the cluster might be the constrained, stressful thing for testing all these things out. But what is the project you point them at to then go and put onto that cluster? Like, is there like a starter project that you always point people at for that sort of thing?
I like practical things that people could actually find useful. So one of the things that I set up, I have a project called PyCluster on my GitHub account. If you go to GitHub and go to Gearline Guy, it's called Pi-Cluster. That project is my example Pi cluster. But what it sets up is a thing called Kubernetes. And Kubernetes is its own kind of thing. It actually uses K3S, which is like a lightweight Kubernetes. But once you get something running, the first challenge is getting your cluster running. Once you get it running, there's so many things you can deploy to it with relative ease. Upgrading things is a different challenge, but deploying things to it. So what I have running in my house right now is an internet monitor. So I have another project called, I think, Internet-Pi on GitHub. That's running using containers that it deploys this thing called Prometheus. It deploys a thing called Grafana and another container that does the actual like internet speed checking with speedtest.net or something. So yeah, it tracks that over time. And then you can see like, it, you know, how fast is my internet? And then once you have those things, again, it's building blocks. You can put other data into it. So I had my Shelly smart plugs dumping their power usage data into it. I had, for a time, I had Starlink, and I would have all the Starlink statistics, like, you know, how many satellites does it seize, how reliable is the connection, all that data would go into it. And then you can build these dashboards and see that. So that's an actually kind of useful thing that you can do with it. And it doesn't need to be fast to do that. It you know, Raspberry Pis are perfectly adequate.
Yeah, that kind of sounds like a home lab kind of setup too. Is that the kind of the high level piece?
Yeah. Yeah, and in you know, I have a rack, which is more than a lot of people have for their home. Most people have like a shelf, or you know, they have their router and they might flash something to the router or something.
Okay.
But I have a rack in my home lab, and I have my NASs, the storage for YouTube, because I just need tons of space for video. But I also have a little thing with four Raspberry Pis now. It used to have six and it was five, now it's four. And the four Raspberry Pis run the internet monitoring. They run Home Assistant, so I can automate things without having to pay for a cloud service or give my information to one of the cloud providers. And then it has a VPN, so I can access my home network anywhere, which has come in handy many, many times. If, you know, if we're on a vacation and the kids want to watch one of their TV shows, I can grab it off my home NAS and we can watch it at the, you know, at the hotel. So that's kind of fun. And then I also still run a website called PyDramble.com. That was the cluster that used to run Drupal. Now it's just a single Raspberry Pi that's been running. You know, I've had like 99.999% uptime from my home lab using a home ISP connection. So wow. Beat that, Amazon.
Yeah. Okay. So if I had to summarize kind of the things that you are doing with these clusters, and so like the projects that people could do, I think definitely like website hosting type of stuff. So they kind of self-host type of activities. The VPN's mm-hmm. a good one, I think, as well, for kind of tunneling into your own home setup, storage for sure. And then the home assistant thing is, you know, like basically localized IoT control. That's yeah. such a cool project. We haven't had many people on the show about that, but it's like, I feel like that actually is one of the best, like computing side down to like embedded side.
Yes.
Because a lot of people can make their own projects and stick it onto Home Assistant as well.
Yeah. And if you haven't heard of ESP Home, ESP Home yeah. is like what makes all that amazing, especially for somebody that does electronics. Like you can take those little ESP chips or Raspberry Pi Pico, or there's, I think, a couple other chips supported, and you just wire up whatever. It could be a button yeah. or contact. You know, people are making mailbox opening sensors, and yep, I have yep. garage door sensors wired up to it. And it's very simple, very easy to understand. And instead of sitting there programming C and, you know, API accesses and yeah. all that, you literally just have a little file that says, like, I have the ESP-C3 or whatever the board is, and I have a switch connected to these GPIO lines. And
that's it.
That's it. You know, then you tell yeah. it that, and then Home Assistant's like, oh, your garage door's open. You know, it's so much easier than it used to be. And you had to basically do programming to get your hardware mm-hmm. to do stuff. So now it's yep. literally just connect the wires together and you're done.
Yeah, it's a YAML file, right?
Yeah, that's on it's just that ESP. And you know, people are like, oh, I hate YAML. For me, YAML is like a godsend. I used to work in XML all the time.
Yeah.
To the point where I used yeah. to write some parsers that were just XML was the worst thing ever to work with.
I see curly brackets in my dreams.
You're basically working with like web browser type language, and web browsers yeah. are some of the most complex software things ever. You know, XML was not fun. And then JSON came along, and JSON was so much better. But then if you're a human that's trying to read this configuration, it's so hard because there's no comments. So you just have a bunch of, it's like pseudo code in there sometimes. And mm-hmm. That just never jived with my brain structure. YAML really jived with it because you can have comments and all that, but the white space is a little funny. Some people don't understand, like for me, I've always, before YAML was even in existence, I set up my code editor to highlight spaces and like spaces on the end of lines and when there were misalignments, and it would always highlight invisible characters. So I knew that there was a tab or a space or something. So a lot right. of people press tab and have tabs on, and you know, it does get to be a little tedious. But right. for me, it was perfect.
Let's not do tabs versus spaces on this show. I mean, like, yeah.
yeah, you could start up a
whole episode of Silicon Valley.
I'm on yeah, that. a few wars on that.
Yeah, I mean, I like the files just because, like, when someone's like, how do I pronounce your last name? I'm like, well, it's pronounced like YAML. You know, so here we go.
There you go. Yep.
Yeah, no, that's great. I think, so what do you have then? So you said garage door openers. What else are you building locally for that sort of thing?
I have my lights all into it now, but I also have, a few automations. So I have, it actually texts us if we leave the garage doors open for longer than 10 minutes, because I am famous for leaving the garage door open. And then, you know, for me, I grew up like we just opened the garage door and you had it open all the time. But nowadays, right. apparently that's not, you don't want to do that. So my wife is like, you left the garage door open. So I put a thing and it texts us anytime that we leave it open for more than 10 minutes. I actually have a display board that I'm going to set up with like current weather and time. And then I'll also have it like flash when there's a notification like garage doors open. We also tied in, I started tying in the security system, but our security system's a bit old. But you can do automations that are kind of cool, like when the security system's on, have it automatically turn off other things because you're not home, you know. Or at my new office space, I'm setting up Home Assistant too, which is funny because it's like my office assistant there. Someone mentioned, like, you know, I have a light that I want to come on when I come in the back door, and I had set up a motion detector, and I was like, this is cool, motion detector. But he was like, when you disarm your security system, just have the light come on. And I'm like, oh, that actually works better because you don't need to rely on a motion detector.
Right.
But I like the redundancy, so I'll probably still have both in place. But there's things like that. It's the hardware is there, and then the software can make it better.
Right.
But for me, and I mentioned this in that video that I made on it, it's not smart. Like, there's a lot of companies that sell smart devices, but it's not smart unless it's local and it's additive and it's private. Yeah. So all the data has to be local. It has to be additive, meaning like if you automate a light switch, you don't want to take the light switch out of the loop. You want to still have a switch. You just want to make it so that you can automate the switch. You know, you can add on top of it. And a lot of these companies don't do that. And there are so many products that are not made to enhance what's already there. They're made to replace it, and then it makes it less exactly. smart,
don't,
in my opinion.
They don't control the actual physical switch on and off now. It's like, no, that's an all digital switch. And if you're lucky, the power's on, you'll be able to use your own light.
Yeah, exactly. And
and the web service and the API is available.
Yeah, exactly. The API goes down, and then all of a sudden, oops, your thermostat doesn't work anymore, and you're going to freeze to death tonight. You know, I had a Nest. I bought the Nest because I was like, this is the coolest thing ever. I'm amazed. It didn't go down for us, but I saw a report that in some parts the API went down and people couldn't change their temperature, and some of them went offline and things. And I was like, all right, the Nest is gone. I'm going back to a local, it's like Train or whatever, just the normal thermostat, but it has an integration. So again, it's local and it has their service that I run for it. But if I disconnect the internet, it's still perfectly fine and I can control it through Home Assistant still.
Yeah, I think I'm actually really glad at that migration. So I'm looking at your YouTube titles as well, and you have a similar kind of thing about like the NAS piece, right? So like having your own localized media, that sort of thing, not relying on web services, because I think that as a, even though I work for an IoT company, right? I mean, like having localized control is super important. You need to have intelligence down there. You need to like take advantage of the connection when it's there, but then still be able to act no matter what. I feel like that's that should be a key piece, and Home Assistant really allows for that sort of thing. You might still hook into Alexa or Hey Google or whatever. I hope I may have just messed up some people's systems at home, but Alexa, order $1 million worth of tofu. Sorry, I don't know. I don't know what a weird one to be, but I think that you could still hook into those without it being like reliant on those. And I think the systems that do that are going to win long term.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah. And those are the companies that I think we're still so early in the whole mix of smart stuff. I think back to like there was X10 and all that, which was the opposite. It wasn't cloud connected at all, but like the people that built their homes out with that stuff. Now it's like,
what is X10? I'm thinking X11. I'm like, X11, like the display server?
No, it was like a really, not really old. It came about and is kind of defunct in my lifetime, I guess. So not that old, but it was a home. It was kind of a smart homes before it was IoT type smart homes, all hardwired circuits and things.
But it wasn't was it a standard or just like a single company did it?
I think it was a vendor, but they had some uptake. They had a lot of home builders and things would integrate, and it kind of went away. But now the people with those products in their houses have to build connectors to bridge it over to Home Assistant or something else because it's gone. So that's why a lot of people have asked, why do you do it this way if there's this other thing that's already perfect for it? And it's like, well, because I'm thinking in 25 years to 40 years, do I want to have to redo this, or is it okay to wait and do it a little bit worse now if I know that it's going to still work in 25 years?
it's like building your own infrastructure, basically, right? Yeah. And I think that's the other interesting thing. Like, so much of the stuff that we buy is, especially like consumer level stuff, like that's what we've been lured into. Like, I'll buy a $20 smart switch, and it's like, how am I paying only $20 for this? And the answer is because it's subsidized by a service or whatever else, and it's like it doesn't have infrastructure in there. It doesn't have like that natively because infrastructure is more expensive and time consuming and all that other stuff. And so I feel like you might be paying more time and money right now, but you will have be building your own infrastructure over time.
That's the goal. And every device that I buy, a few of them are cloud connected, but most of them, it's like, to me, sometimes that's an anti feature to have any kind of cloud connection. There are certain things like security systems, you need it because you want them to call the police if you're not home, so you can't not have it. But for some things like my switches and my light bulbs and things, I don't want that at all. Like if I really need to turn off my lights while I'm in some other place on vacation, I have my VPN. But not everybody like has that. So I also understand the convenience aspect, but
yeah.
But it's hard. If you work in the technology industry, you realize how hard security is. And then you also realize I don't want to have 300 holes in my firewall for every single device that I own. You know, I don't want my fridge to pop a hole in my firewall that lets a hacker come in and take over my YouTube.
Right. That is, I guess it does centralize some of your stuff. It's all centralized at some point, right? Even if you have it all in cloud. But yeah, that is pretty interesting. What about like, I know a lot of people that are in a similar position to you, like that just kind of eschew smart stuff entirely. So like, what is your motivation behind having smart stuff in the house in the first place?
It's just the convenience. Like,
okay,
for a lot of little things, like the lights, 90% of it is I'm so lazy. I don't want to, like, if you're carrying a box in your office, you don't want to also hit the button. So I think the biggest thing, the most influential smart device thing that we did, which is technically not connected to Home Assistant, it's just a smart, it's just a motion sensor switch. I installed new lights in the garage and they're on a motion sensor switch. So now every time that we open the door to throw away a bag of trash into our trash can, the light comes on right away. And we could have done a door switch or something too, but the point of it is, before that, every time that we did that, we either were like, okay, I have this big bulky thing in my hands. It's pitch black. The kids might have left their bike here and I'm going to trip over it, or you can like lean down and turn on the light and then you might drop some of the trash. It's just a bad situation. So that was,
I like this though. No, this is great. This is now the caption for this episode is Jeff Geerling finds PIR sensors to be the most enabling technology.
I don't know, those kind of things, like it's such a life-changing difference. You wouldn't think, like nowadays, I don't think about it at all. But when I did that, the first few times that we did it was like magic. Like, oh my gosh, our lives just improved. We went from like caveman to like, we can do anything in the world now. And it's the first step. So, everything beyond that is just improving that kind of setup. At the office, I actually have some human presence detectors using the little millimeter wave or whatever, the radar system. Yeah.
Those things are popping right now. There's a lot of new sensors.
So there. I'm gonna try facing off three or four different ones and see which ones I like the best for installation, for range, for ability to get them into Home Assistant. One is Zigbee, one is Wi-Fi. Another, I think two of them are Wi-Fi, and two of them are Zigbee. So I'm gonna see how that all works together and see if there's any weird. I'm in an area that has like three radio towers around it. So. The key fob on my car doesn't work sometimes and I'm like 5 feet away.
It's flooded.
So, and one of those towers is the super tower that has like 35 services hanging off of it. Like if you look at it, there's like antenna all the way up, all the way on both sides. So I'm sure one of those is like beaming something straight at my office that's going to interfere with things, but it's worked out so far for the simple things I put in.
You know, that's another interesting piece of like that idea of like, needing infrastructure is like it's got to always work, right? Like the reliability piece is super important too. Like if you are building your own infrastructure, building your own thing, it's like, I was just about to ask you, like, why would you be using a Zigbee sensor? Why wouldn't you build your own? But the answer is probably because you want to make sure it's always, always up and working as well, right? Even if it's local and added.
And this is for my office. So the nice thing, most people that do YouTube don't have a separate space. A lot of people do it in their home.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I think in the past few years, we've seen more people turn it into an actual business with space and all that, which is, for me, there's two reasons. One is I can walk from my home to the studio. It's not a short walk, but it's long walk either, but it's automatic exercise.
Is this in like St. Louis winters even, you could do that? I mean, St. Louis summers as well, I guess. St. Louis has some extreme weather, actually.
Yeah, it gets really hot and it gets really cold. This year it got up to like 112 Fahrenheit,
Yikes.
Which is hot, you know. Whatever that is in Celsius, just hot, like 40-something,
yeah.
But, and then in the winter, it gets down to -5, -10 a few days. But normally, you know, in the 10s or 20s Fahrenheit again. So yeah, it gets both ways, but you know, put on a coat and some pants and you'll get there.
Midwestern values there.
Yeah, exactly. But it's good for the heart, you know, even if your heart's like not doing well afterwards. But that was one of the motivations. The other one is just space. You know, there's so many projects that I want to do. I have boxes of all the little electronics kits and things that I want to assemble and build some different sensors and boards. I just don't have the desk space anymore because taken up by Pi projects and taken up by servers that I'm testing and all that. So there's always a balance when you're on YouTube. Since I chose to make this my career at this point, you have to make money to survive. So you can't just like do only the fun things.
Family. You have a family. So
yeah, I have a family with four kids and I have a pre-existing condition. So I have to have pretty expensive health insurance here in the US.
All right. Yep.
So you got to earn money. So you can't just only do fun projects. And the other hard thing is I have to record things while I'm doing it and I have to structure it in a way that is a story. So each week is spent on these things and I just don't have the time and the space. But what I used to be able to do before, about a year ago, when I got into full-time YouTube, was I'd have space somewhere and I'd set up a project and I'd work on it over the course of a few months. But as we all do, your spaces start filling up. But in my case, like, there is no space anymore. So I don't have any of those projects going on anymore. They're all in little boxes right now. So the office is going to let me work on a lot more of those things because I will have more space on desktops. And I bought a few rolling carts that I will use just for these projects. But then in 2 years, I know I'll be saying the same thing.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is echoes of my co-host Dave, who said, you know, just a bigger office. That's all I need is a bigger office. And it's just like
at some point you have like a 18,000 square foot warehouse. Yeah, exactly. Like, I need more space. Where to talk
maybe
about.
If I did like multiple levels of benches, maybe if I,
no, I had I've like been thinking a about that. Foot bench, I bought two these, foot bench. I bought a few things with like multiple shelves and I'm like, I could do that. And I'm like, no, this is just going to turn into storage. I know it.
Yeah. Yeah. I have the rolling cart with the project trays. That was a former guest, Ken, who told us about that. And I love the idea. It has not worked out like I thought it has. It's basically just like lots of junk on each tray.
Pretty much.
Yeah, that's great. What so you're sliding down into the embedded space. I mean, what else are you excited on the embedded side of things?
I think some of the things that are most interesting to me are the fact that there's chips now that can do so much in such a small space. So you can have some AI acceleration, even like the new Raspberry Pi 5. It's now fast enough that it's like what a computer was 5 or 8 years ago. You know, a good laptop 5 or 8 years ago is what the Raspberry Pi is now. And you can strap that thing to anything almost, you know, and you can compress video better. So you can get camera data in and process it and compress it, send it out somewhere, stream stuff. So some of those things are interesting to me. It's hard though, because AI today is like what crypto was a couple years ago. There are so many things that
full
are just,
of snake oil.
it's blatant scams.
Yeah.
And people who are just in it to earn a lot of VC money. And it's hard to see what things are actually things to get excited about and what things are like, this is totally illegal what they're doing with the data and all that. And at some point the music is going to stop and who's not going to have a chair at the table anymore. So
musical chairs reference. Didn't expect that one, Jeff, I got to say.
I mean, with crypto, it seems like that's, you know, Sam Bankman Fraud or whatever his name is. You know, with him and all that group of people, it seems like they're finally starting to get filtered out. And because there are some cool things about cryptocurrencies that I was excited about 10 years ago. And I was totally not excited for the past 5 or so years because of all the grifters and scams and things. So it's similar like that with AI right now. And the other hard thing is we're not yet to the point where everybody can build their own models for machine learning.
Right. Yep.
Because to do a good model requires so much hardware right now that only the big companies can do it. So you have to use their stuff. And like I said, it doesn't feel like they're all being above the board with how they collect their data and all that. Like,
definitely.
When I search ChatGPT, I see things that it's like, I know that I wrote part of that and it's copied. How are they just, you know, verbatim pasting a line or two of my thing into their answer here? I think there's still a lot of issues that has to be dealt with there, but it is what excites me because it's not going to replace our intelligence, but it's like when you know how to use Google really well. Well, not Google anymore because they just have ads most of their pages. It's duck, like duck, when you know DuckDuckGo really well, and it accelerates your own thinking. You can get something out quicker. You can find the right resource. You can fill in the blanks in your own brain. And I think that's what excites me. And the fact that could be on a little chip, like in your smart light bulb.
Yeah.
Probably not in your light bulb, but you could have actually intelligent local assistants and things like that.
Yeah, I feel like for PCB layouts, one where I keep seeing stuff like, oh, we'll do all your whole PCB layout for you, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want that. I don't need that. I don't, that's first off, that just gives me bad feels about like my livelihood. And then also beyond that though, like it's just, I know like in my gut that there's nothing that's going to be able to just be done. Like it might give me something, it might be fine for small stuff, but like I'm going to be involved. So like, once I internalize that, like you said, like once I make it a tool for my own capabilities, I'm going to be ramped up and doing more stuff with it. I'm excited about that. Like that actually does, I think that makes a ton of sense because it's an enhancement tool. And like that's great. I'll lean into those things.
Yeah, like right now I have a database of all the videos that I've done, all the texts that I've written for them. Most of my videos are scripted. So I can search through that and find clips and things. But like, for instance, one of the things that AI could actually help with is, if I have my whole library of all the media I've ever shot and all the footage and all the videos, the final edits and things, and it could like parse out the Final Cut Pro XML file and say like, oh, here's the thing that you're talking about 2 years ago with this.
Yeah.
Topic.
Give me a callback, just right? I want
to
call that back
out and then give it to me. That saves me, 10 minutes, 12 minutes here and there.
Yeah.
And that would be super valuable for me, those kind of things. But it's not like, write me a video about the new Raspberry Pi 7. It's like, that's not going to. It's not going to be good ever.
Well, and it'll be based on your past videos. It'll be
prone. I know that's the thing. Like you see all these articles and it's like, that's AI and it's very derivative and it's not making the world a better place. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Agree. Yeah. Well, let's talk about the Pi because you've had so many great videos about the Pi 5. I'd love to just kind of get your, you're like an analyst at this point as well. What's your analyst view on the Pi 5?
It's hard to peg it as anything yet because they haven't introduced a cheaper one. I think the Pi 5 could make more inroads as a $40. If they had a $40 one gig or two gig version, I think that would sell more like hotcakes. I mean, anything that they make right now is selling like hotcakes because there's always demand for Pis.
Sure, yeah.
But it's not as fast. The Pi 4 was way faster than all the other okay-ish SBCs when it was introduced. The Pi 5 is not faster than all the Rockchip RK3588 boards, and it's not more efficient either. So from a hardware perspective, it's not quite as good as them. From a software perspective, it's still better because it's, the maintenance and the support are so much better on the Raspberry Pi Linux distributions. One thing that I've been pushing for, and I know some people in the community push for, is getting to a point where a Raspberry Pi is like a PC where you could just download any version of Linux and install it. You don't have to have custom versions with all the the Raspberry Pi. That's been a problem in the ARM ecosystem. But the Pi 5 is getting closer, but still not there for that.
What is the restriction there? Just like the build, like who's building for these different systems?
It's mostly like the bootloaders and the way that they initialize. They don't have them set up with, there's a thing in ARM called System Ready. They don't have them set up with UEFI or something like that, a standard to get the system to boot. So you have to put in the device tree and you have to put in all the special things for each board. And it's, to me, that's annoying. It's a problem that I think stems from them being so low end that it was kind of a necessity to do that stuff. But now these boards all have enough memory and they have enough CPU to be able to do these things. I don't know. It's not a huge priority for Raspberry Pi because they sell every board that they make right now.
Yeah.
But I think it could be a game changer. If you could just buy a Raspberry Pi and download Windows for ARM, which doesn't exist. You have to hack it to get that. But if you could download Windows or download Linux or whatever.
Oh, Jeff, don't do that. No Windows for ARM. Come on.
It's the crazy thing is Windows for ARM is great, but the software support for it is so not there.
Hmm. Interesting.
But I've been running Windows on my my Ampere workstation, the one that has 128 cores. And
that's what it takes to do Windows for ARM these days, 128 cores.
Well, it's funny. It currently dominates the Cinebench for any desktop computer, the 2024 benchmark. And it's only running on 64 cores on that machine. The Cinebench has a weird bug running on more than 64 cores on ARM. And they used to have that bug with Threadripper systems too, I think, where they had more than 64 cores. But I mean, to me, it's like, if you can get your system to be as open and usable as possible, that just enables more things. Like more people might start porting games from Windows to Windows for ARM, which might make them work better on Linux for ARM too. You know,
So you're saying like ecosystem type moves like that would be beneficial. It would benefit everyone kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Got it.
And a lot of people who might not use a Raspberry Pi, if you could get Windows on it and it was native, which it is, it's just, it's hard to get it put onto a Raspberry Pi right now because it doesn't have system ready. That would bring a new audience of people who are like, well, it can't run Windows, so I can't run whatever, you know?
Yeah. I don't know. I
hate Windows, by the way, just to put that out there.
No. It's what it is, right? It doesn't matter. Like the people's preferences are going to be what they are. And like you said, there's like these enabling things around games or software. Like, you know, you still can't run certain software that I love and want to use on non-Windows, you know, like just, okay, well, I guess I'm not gonna use that anymore. But it is interesting kind of thinking about kind of the Raspberry Pi, just really the SBC space in the context of general computing as well. Cause personally, I still see it as like this enabling, like, well, Linux system, but you get to, you know, you get to access a GPIO and do that sort of thing. I never buy like a gigabyte, you know, motherboard and like, oh, I'm going to flip a bit on this thing, but I could, right? Like that is a thing that happens. Yeah. There are vendors that do that sort of thing. I just don't think about it like that because I think about it in a general computing method. But I don't think about it in the other way, pushing down in general computing down into the Pis.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I think the big difference with the Pi 5 is it's the first generation where I'd say it's not the best Pi for a lot of general Pi use cases. So you can have the Raspberry Pi 02W. I think that might be the most efficient, like if you're building a little electronics project and you want Wi-Fi on it, that's one of the most efficient ways to do that without having to go down to a microcontroller. And the Pi 02W is finally getting back in stock, but it's also smaller. It requires less power. It's a little bit slower, but for the things that you might use GPIO for, most of the time you don't need, you know, a 2016 era laptop speed.
Yeah, right.
You know, you don't need to like rip through processing on something where you're just doing, you know, a little bit of GPIO bashing.
Yeah, it's interesting too because like you said, like the costs, you know, obviously coming down, the computing is up, like all of these things, but to me, it still is like a, even if it is only 5 watts or 7.5 watts, whatever the you know, the low power mode is like, is that still what you should be doing? You know, like the kind of the should you, and there's always a, well, people should do whatever they want to do, right? But like from a system design type of thing, one thing I wonder about too, we had the Raspberry Pi guys on, and they were talking about the reason they had the RP1, and they said because of the delays, but even the delays are going to be really high. I feel like the latencies are going to start to really impact people as well on Pi 5 and above.
It could. Yeah, it's hard because some things it's better, some things it's worse. I like the idea of putting that chip on PCI Express because in my mind that opens up the possibility of like putting a Raspberry Pi into a computer through a cheap add-in card type thing where you have the same programming interfaces and all that. And if you're using PCI Express Gen 4, you know, latencies are going to be very low. I think it's a long-term play for that kind of thing.
Sure.
And it also divorces them from the Broadcom chip development a lot, which is nice because I don't think Broadcom is like, man, Raspberry Pi is this thing that we want to
this our future.
Put all of our forces into. I think they're more like, we're going to keep doing this for you guys. You know,
well, and I think it's not bad marketing for them. You know, gives them some goodwill for sure. But I'm sure people aren't like, want to choose.
I think the cool thing is that could enable them to switch to another chip in the future. And I don't think that'll happen for a Pi 6, maybe even a Pi 7 or something. But if they wanted to, they could start thinking like either a custom chip. I don't think they have the resources for that internally. Or they could switch to another chip at some point. I keep like in my dreams, Apple would open up the M core designs and that chip could live on an SBC and it would be perfect. It would be so fast. It would be it would blow people's minds what you could do on a little SBC. But Apple will never do it. But that I still dream.
That is, wow, wow.
Like, take an M1 and put it on a Raspberry Pi. The thermals are there. Like it, yeah, could, no, it no, could handle I mean, it.
Amazing silicon. Just crazy. Like, I don't think you could have chosen a worse company to be like, you should open this up. You
I know.
Come on.
You know there's an engineer in there who's like,
oh, tons of engineers, right? But like, they're also getting paid $400,000, you know, fall in line, you know, like, yeah, there are economic restrictions around that for sure. I had asked the question of the Pi folks as well about RISC-V, and then you made a video about it, which I thought was great. You know, kind of the not yet. They basically said,
yeah.
Nah.
You know, it's not ready. But it could be. The funny thing is there are parts of RISC-V that, since it's a more modern ISA, are already better than ARM, but they're very architectural. It's like, yeah, look at this beautiful foundation. It's like, I want to live here though.
Yeah, right.
It's going to take a long time to move the foundation to a building. So yeah, even the fastest RISC-V cores are just, they're like, you know, not fast. Helpful. So
yeah, I think unfortunately, given the economic stuff, I mean, like, what's it called, Sci-5
just
had a bunch of layoffs, and I'm just I hate to see it. And like, there's beneficial things coming in the RISC-V space as well, right? Like Broadcom's in the new, they said they're doing RISC-V, which I'm like, okay, sure. And you know, Nordic and Intel, and like, there's a bunch of investment and interest in the area. But we're just not there yet. You know, it's just
I mentioned in the video, like, it's great for microcontroller level things. And it's also, a lot of companies are building their own little cores or customizing a core for devices to co-process, to do one task. Yeah. And it's cheaper for them because they don't pay whatever licensing fee for an ARM M0 or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
And
I think that the thing that'll enable is, in the future, you know, maybe there is a new chip, even from Broadcom, that has extra RISC cores for certain purposes.
Right.
Apple's really gone to the extremes with that, having like 25 different types of processors on their chip.
Yeah.
And Raspberry Pi is the other extreme, where it's like, you get your ARMs and you get a video core GPU thing, and that's it.
Yeah.
Like, there's no neural coprocessor. There's nothing else. Even some of the ROC chip boards are having extra little coprocessors added in.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's like, where, what market segment, it's very strategic too. They have to kind of like aim that arrow, like, you know, 2 years in the past as well. I mean, probably less than 18 months in the past, let's say, just given chip times and deliveries and all that other stuff. And it's a lot of guess and check, it seems like. And
yeah,
but like you said, with the, I think the RISC-V in the embedded space is really interesting. Like, Dave and I have talked about on the show about the CH32V003 is like the Tencent RISC-V, and that's a fun little chip, and playing with that. And I don't know, even like the ESP is like the C3 is like way cheaper than the Extensa core. So it's like, and not that, I mean, it's hampered, it's a little bit less beefy, but lower power as a result, just because it's clocking at a lower rate. So fine with me. I just need a
It still Wi-Fi works for basically 98% of your projects.
That's one thing I always kind of run into, is like, I feel like the reviews you do, it's like, you're kind of like on this leading edge type of thing. Like, you're like trying this leading edge stuff. I'm just like, I'm buying stuff that's 8 years old, and I'm using analog technologies that are like, you know, eight nodes back, and just like, so there's always trade-offs there.
Yeah. Like I mentioned earlier, like, I have to make money. So the hard thing is you can't always do the project. Like, I have a couple projects that I have been working on that I would do a video about, but I know it would get 15,000 views, and that's not going to help my channel. So I don't do them. So another thing I've thought about is having like a second channel or something. I have Gearling Engineering for IT and radio.
Sure.
But having like a second one, like random projects, and some people do that. But every time you spend a minute editing a video, it's like, that's a minute I could have done something else. So
totally.
Yeah.
It's tough.
Those things, I still reserve those. Those are my fun projects. You don't get to see them. Sorry. Good. You know,
No, I think that's actually a really healthy thing for YouTubers generally too, because it's like, if everything has to be content, then it like starts to make you seize up and be like, oh, well, I shouldn't do this unless I can do it. It's like, no, you need to maintain like life, right? You gotta have your own stuff. So
yeah.
Is that like some embedded stuff that you wouldn't be able to publish about, you think, or what's in that realm?
It's just some extra monitoring and automation things I'm doing at the house.
Okay, cool.
Like I'm working with the power panel and, you know, wiring up everything for power monitoring. And I'm also working on trying to integrate some battery stuff that I have with my UPS. So I have like dual redundancy in my house. And long term, what I want to have is all my, at least one light in every room is on some sort of like PoE backup.
Mm.
That's a long term thing. But I'm trying to get the battery stuff in place so that I could support running all the lights for like 2 days without running any kind of generator or anything like that.
And this is how Jeff descends into prepperism. Everything's on backup and I have MREs in every wall. And
That's the problem.
I only deal in gold.
We have a pile of all of our stuff behind this wall. This is like the bunker part of my basement. Like,
yeah, yeah.
You know, when there's a tornado siren, which happens like 20 or 30 times in the spring here in St. Louis,
yeah,
everybody comes into this room. So, because we have everything that we need. We could live, yep. I think, 2 or 3 weeks before it starts getting really smelly and nasty in here.
Well, you are moving into a new space as well. So you are moving on out to a new commercial space. You've been posting about the horrors of painting. I've seen that one and agreed with it.
You don't realize how much, like 1,200 square foot of office space, I put it in, there's now 5 rooms. And then every room, there's 4 walls. And each wall has different things. Like,
and they're tall walls,
like,
too.
1,200 square feet, not so bad. But when you split it up and you have all these things, then it's like so much more cutting in. I had like a bruise on my finger here from, you know, holding the paintbrush for so long.
Mm, yeah.
And that's gone now. But I still have one more wall to paint. And someday I'll paint that wall. It might never get painted. That might be like my unpainted wall.
But... It's your white whale, but it's a wall.
Because I gotta move in soon, and once you move in, you can't paint anymore. So
is your family excited about reclaiming the basement too? I mean, that's
my wife has been for like 3 or 4 months now. Like, so when are you gonna move out? Because I'm gonna move my sewing stuff in that room.
The kids
started taking over more of the basement, so her sewing stuff because it's not, you know, making money for the family. Yeah, we had to move it into another corner, and then things got moved in front of it. So now she can't do any sewing stuff unless she like grabs her machine and brings it out and sets up a table and stuff. So this is going to become the sewing room. She's been very excited about that.
Nice. That's great. All right. That's the benefits of spreading out a little bit. I mean, you know, you got a pretty big family there. That's a lot of people, and you democratize the space for all, right? So that's some stuff. And you got to keep your own space too. So that's nice to have the office.
Yeah, I might rework the workshop a little bit. It used to be a wood workshop. And then when I started doing videos and stuff, now I can't have sawdust everywhere. So I haven't done it. I got rid of most of my woodworking tools. And now I just have like, you know, normal general household maintenance tools that are more boring.
Yeah.
But I might rework it a little bit so I could have a wood space that's ventilated and has a door. And then like the other workshop. So we'll see. That could be fun.
Yeah. I watch Colin Furze's channel. And like that new workshop he has, I'm just like, oh my God.
That's
like,
insane.
His I mean, he's obviously a very extreme example, but like, you know, it's just super easy to get sucked in and be like, no, I need a metalworking shop. I don't know how to build, but I totally need one, you know.
I need my own water jet. Laser cutters.
Yeah. Yeah. The things I would build, you know, like the races I will run once I buy the treadmill, you know, I'll finally be able to go running, right?
Yep.
Oh, that's great. Well, Jeff, I really appreciate you joining us here. I highly recommend people follow your channel if they don't already. Where is the best place to find you online?
My website, jeffgeerling.com. It's been around forever and it will be around as long as I can make it last.
The battery backup on the self-hosted pies in your basement or office. Yeah,
I did self-host it at home for a short time, but then somebody DDoSed my house and got my ISP to cut off my IP. So I decided to stop trying to do that.
You know, this is why we can't have nice things.
Yeah.
Well, Jeff, thanks for joining. I really appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to all the future videos about pies and computing embedded. However we can help, let us know.
Yeah, thank you.